Hi, you're listening to Secrets for an Inspirational Life with me, your host, Mimi Novick. I'm so happy and thrilled to have you here with me. I have created this series for all of us so we can change our world together and live a more holistic and balanced life. Together, we will share lots of inspiring stories from all walks of life, speak with leading experts, enjoy healthy living ideas, explore music and subjects that inspire each other to always have hope. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate all of you. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Secrets for an Inspirational Life. How are you all today? I hope that you are feeling good. I hope that you're feeling fine and that whatever life is throwing at you or serenading you, wherever you may be in the world, I hope there are some beautiful moments out there. And you know, one thing that I have learned and I'm still learning through this magical journey of life is that no moment is ever repeated twice. Everything that we have now is all that we have. The past is gone, the future, as I always say, we don't know what that holds, but it's this present moment that we can share with friends and loved ones and actually even sometimes with people that are not really our type of people, because whoever we meet, there is always something that we can learn from that encounter. And it all happens for a reason. Sometimes we don't realize until the end of that experience, and sometimes it's further along in life. But whatever it is, always grab this beautiful opportunity to learn, to live, and to really taste life in all its glory. Now, I am super excited. As you all know, I'm always excited about my guests, but I'm truly excited today because this is a very special guest. And he is the very, very lovely Phil Rees. Phil is an esteemed singer, songwriter, and percussionist who has worked with major artists. He was in the well-known band Talk Talk for many years. Phil has worked with major musicians such as Nina Cherry, Louise Goffin, The Blockheads, and Massive Attack, and his music has taken him across the globe. Now, he was originally taught, which is an interesting story, by a master drummer in Lagos, Nigeria, as a nine-year-old. While in Africa, he said, it is this actual encounter that changed his whole world for the rest of his life. He returned to the UK and played percussion in local bands before being invited onto John Peel's show in the 70s. He then moved to London and joined Pauline Black's band. At one of her shows, the chief road manager of Talk Talk alerted Mark Hollis, which was one of the lead members of the band, who asked him to turn up at rehearsals. And that was actually the beginning to his long and successful career in the music business. Currently, he is working on a very fabulous project with a French band that includes Mel Gaynor, who is the ex-Simple Minds drummer. So watch this space. Today, he shares his amazing life story. Welcome, dear Phil.
My word, what a wonderful introduction, Mimi. Thank you.
Oh, just for you, really. And you deserve it so much. I'm thrilled, truly, to have you here today. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Yes. Good, good. And what is life and what's the weather? We have to ask these questions. Well, where you are.
Oh, my word. We've had rain today. We've had wonderful sunshine for at least 20 minutes. There seems to be a gale blowing. We've got cloud, no rain, but the trees are doing a very wonderful balatic bending and weaving at the moment. So I'm not sure if the wind's going to bring the rain or take it away again. I'm not sure. But typical eclectic English weather.
Ah, people always laugh when I'm in England and I always have my car and it has three lots of changes in it, because you just never know, do you? It's a just in case type of moment in every moment.
It's the only time I get changed more times than a baby.
Oh, now tell us, you have done so much and you have had such an interesting life. Let's go back to the beginning. Tell us a little bit about where this whole life of yours started, especially, which I'm fascinated to hear about, this master drummer in Nigeria. That sounds like a fascinating story, because you were only 9 years old. And it's one of those things, I think, that when children know from a very early age what they want to do, and they're committed to it, it really is the sort of setting for their whole life.
I believe that's true, yes. In my case, I think especially true. It ties in with one of my earliest vivid memories, the ones that you remember like they were yesterday. I'm sure we've all got one or two of these. The first memory I have, I'd be even younger than that. And I decided that we'd gone to nursery. Apparently, there was a break, and I thought that was home time. And because it was near my house, I walked home, giving everybody a shock. I just turned up. But I remember that. But then the most vivid one was my mother and my father were estranged. They weren't together until I was nine. I didn't meet my father. And one day we were walking home from school and she said to me, "How would you like to go and see your dad?" Well, it's a bombshell. I thought, I'd never thought about him or really had any connection whatsoever. So I just said, "Well, yeah, great."
How old were you? Nine?
I was nine at that point, yeah.
Okay. And you'd never met him before?
No. Okay. Never met him before. I'd seen pictures of their wedding. And that was it. He left when I was 2 years old to go back to Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I can tell, he wasn't obviously a very educated man, but he was a very educated man. He was a marine biologist. And when he came to England at that time, he was offered work as a coal man. And I don't think he was appreciating that. So he disappeared and left us to it. But anyway, we arrived in Lagos, and at first I was thinking, this is marvellous. I'm going to be with lots of black people, and I won't get my name called. This is wonderful. And in my playground, I remember the tarmac was obviously a dark tarmac colour, with white lines that we played football on and a football pitch, and we all had grey uniforms. Well, as soon as we got to Nigeria and I went to school, everybody had a white uniform and the tarmac was replaced with some kind of broken down asphalt, which was orange. And instead of getting name called with the N-word, which I was in England, I was called Loimbo, which means white boy. So I felt I jumped out of the frying pan and gone into the fire.
Yeah.
But that was quite strange. That was the first thing. And I was picked on. But my father's brother was a boxer and his older brother was the chief of police. So that was quite strange. And the younger brother, my uncle, said, "Nobody's going to pick on you because I'll teach you how to box." So then I could defend myself. But during that time, I went with the local kids and I could hear drums. There was a festival. And whereas all the other kids went home, I stood and I waited and I watched until this old gentleman, he must have been 150 years old, I don't know, he looked very old. And people were amazed that he was talking to me. And it was treated with great reverence. And I was thinking, well, he's just like one of my uncles. And he said, do you like the drums? And I said, yes, I do. And he said to me, have you ever seen Bobby Charlton? So that made me feel completely at home because he was a Manchester United fan. And I thought that was absolutely amazing. And then he said, I will teach you how to play drums. And all he said to me was, the first lessons were, you don't hit a drum ever. You play it. And that was one of the things that I've tried to inspire in youngsters that's ever asked me how and why. If you're using hand percussion, you can hurt your hands. Well, obviously, that's not what you want. You want to play the drum to make it sound and not to be aggressive with it, which is quite something to handle at that age. But because I was young and small, I would have presumed quite frail, I didn't have much muscle to do any damage to my hands and my wrists. And I learned a technique that is probably known as polyrhythmic. There are various different instruments that he told me and he lent me to use, going from a small goat-skinned drum with a pot, for better of a word, a ring, a pot ring of about 10 inches diameter. And it's something like a tambourine, but obviously with the pots being quite heavy when it's been cast, the drum was then stretched, the head was stretched over that ring and put through with wooden pegs. And you held it with one hand under your arm and played it with either your left or your right hand, depending on which you were left or right-handed. And that was the prelude to playing a talking drum. Talking drums are strapped at either end and you can sling them over your shoulder. And they're like an hourglass. And the leads from one head to the other, you can put under your arm and you play the drum. And when you squeeze your arm into your ribs, it tightens the head and it makes a higher tone. Do, 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 do. That was the next progression. So I didn't think much of this. It was a game. It kept me not thinking about my nana and my dog that were at home and my sisters. And it was wonderful. I learned to play. And then eventually I was able to join in with the festivals. And this only took, well, weeks, basically, 3 or 4, maybe 5 weeks. And after 10 months, I was quite proficient. And again, it was a game. You give children a game and they usually get on with it. There's no pressure involved. And it came as quite a bit of notoriety. People saying, there's Lone Boy, he plays drums, look. So I got used to that. And then it all finished when we came home rather quickly. And before I knew it, I was back on the playground in my grey uniform with the football and the black tarmac with white lines. But this time, when somebody said something I didn't agree with, I remember, terrible, Mimi. I remembered what my uncle had taught me and bopped people on the nose quite frequently. And of course, being quite skinny and smaller than some of the bullies, it quickly gained their respect. And when they knew I could play drums, then I suddenly had all these bullies as minders because they thought it was quite good to hang around with me. That was quite strange. And then shortly after that, as it's, I'll be 11, my sister married a blues musician. And before I knew it, I was in the back of a converted ambulance going to places like Eric's in Liverpool and these blues clubs. And I was playing with characters. Let me remember a few of them. There's a Greasy Bear and Stormy Dunlop and Broxy. And these characters were basically all my mentors. And we finished the gigs. And I'd get back in the ambulance and I'd be sat on top of the amps that were still hot. And in those days, they were all valve amps. And it's this very particular smell that they give off when they're cooling down. And to that day, that gives me goosebumps on the back of my neck. I can think about that. And it's, yeah, I remember this. So it was quite a young stage to be running about with seasoned musicians. And they taught me quite a lot. A lot of it my mother didn't approve of, obviously. But. That's
And how long were you in Nigeria for?
10 months.
10 months. Was the plan to stay there?
It
was. Did you go as a young child thinking you're going to end up staying there? Or what were your thoughts about that?
Well, it was confusing because I suddenly realized I picked up Yoruba language quickly. And at this point, my father decided that what a good idea. He was going to send me to Italy, to a Catholic school in Italy that only knew the priest, because he would teach me languages. And my mother didn't like it at all, because he's come halfway across the world. And then she was going to be separated from me as well as her daughters. And it all went wrong. And we decided to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the end of that. But in the meantime, I'd seen the beggars of Nigeria at close hand. If we went for a picnic and we sat down on a bench in a park, it wouldn't be long before these terribly crippled people had come and begged for the sandwiches that we had, or anything that we had, sweets, sandwiches.
Yeah.
And that was really quite shocking at a young age, to see somebody that didn't have any legs and that all the possessions were on a table-sized skateboard that they'd shuffle around on. Or one of these guys that we knew didn't have a nose. And to look at somebody without a nose is such a very unbelievably strange thing. Or they people that have been affected by all sorts of different diseases. And rather than being a nightmare, it was there, you know, confronted in front of me. And that gave me an awareness of how special everybody is, irrespective of what disability they've got or how their life is unfolding as a very outcast person in society. They didn't look like there was any help for them anywhere. It was very barbaric. They used to have they used to say that we could have a party on the beach, and this would be a public hanging. People would turn up for a public hanging and they'd call it a party, which was bizarre, you know. So all that was something that impressed me and affected me. So when I got back to school in England and people were saying, your tie's not straight, and we're going to give you a reprimand, it didn't really sink in that they were trying to discipline me when there's a lot more important things that they should have been concentrating on. So I think I grew up quicker than I should have done. And combine that with the characters in the ambulance, and the teachers didn't really have a prayer. I had an answer for everything. So from being 12, 13, I was more or less self-educated, I think.
It gave you that inner wisdom, I suppose, to be opened up to such a lifestyle at such an influential age. It is very eye-opening, I think, when we experience things as children. I still remember things from being abroad and remembering some horrific things that I used to see on my travels, and they did in fact shape me, because I know that you said that it sort of changed your life.
Yes.
How, in what way?
Well, I think the awareness of those more important things on a day-to-day basis, having enough to eat, it was the first thing that I often thought of, because obviously there are lots of people starving and taking a lot of things for granted, which I could never understand. And waste, I used to see people, when I got back to England, eating half a chocolate bar, I went, oh, I don't like that, and they throw it away.
Mm.
And at an early age, I couldn't believe it. I thought, well, I've seen people exist on half a sandwich for a day. You know, they'd be glad to eat that. And so it gave me an awareness of a value that I don't think I'd have got normally.
And did you go back again to Nigeria?
No, never been back.
You've never been back since?
No.
I think, do you think you Do you think you will?
I went to Morocco on the holiday. And there again, there were beggars. I went down the wrong side street. And there were beggars in terrible state. And that brought the memories back. And I thought, right, get on the plane tomorrow. Let's go home. That's something that I don't think I could handle that again in respect of seeing such depravity and poverty close up. It's not, I'm not proud of that. It's the fact that I just don't mentally, I don't think I could handle it. Being so close and not being able to help properly. People selling cigarettes for a living, they'd have a packet and people would just walk in the marketplace and they'd stop and buy one cigarette off somebody. And I said, well, why have you done that? I said, well, he hasn't got any money. You know, it's probably people give him cigarettes and he comes out and sells them to you. So we never buy cigarettes. We just buy them when we want one off the people in the streets. And things like that were just incomprehensible to me. You never see it in the Western world, you know, or you hope you wouldn't.
But as an adult, you don't feel that pull. I mean, when you have sort of that ancestry, sometimes it can come at any point in our life that it pulls you to a certain place. Yeah. Because sometimes you have to, I suppose, take the wisdom of that country that, in effect, you have running through your veins.
Yeah, I think I think maybe I mask it and keep the rhythm of the African beat, if you like. Strangely enough, years later, I picked up a bass guitar and I could play it. It was in 1988. I'd finished working with Talk Talk at that point, if we just digress. And I was at the Earls Court Music Festival, a music show, and there was a pyramid of guitars. There might have been 60 guitars in this giant pyramid that was 20 feet high. And the pinnacle, right at the top, there was a fretless Vizier bass guitar made by the French company Vizier. And as I was looking at this, I got drawn towards it. I stood staring at it. And a voice said to me, I can't give that to you, but you can have it. Trade plus 50%. And it was the old roadie from Talk Talk. So that's...
Oh, my goodness.
I know. It's bizarre. And it was... and that's one I'll play for you later. But it's a limited edition one. There's only made 200. That's why it was at the top of the pyramid. It's a beautiful instrument. And I think there was something about Africa that drew me towards that. And the way that I played from day one was as a percussion instrument. And I know that might sound bizarre, but the other African instruments that are strung, one's a kora, which is a large gourd that has strings stretched across it. It's a magical sound. And I think I tried immediately to emulate that with a bass. It doesn't sound like anything, well, it didn't at the time, so anything like a kora. But in my mind, I was thinking of the phrases that I could remember. And again, I think that's a throwback from being imprinted with African rhythm and the smells and the bustle and the... Because Africa at night doesn't really close. You have street markets and they'll have candles lit. And there's always hustle and bustle and bubble and people hurrying and buying and doing what they do.
Yeah, it's true. It's like Egypt. It's the same principle of everything comes to life at 3 a.m. or at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And life begins then. It's a completely different way of living.
It is indeed.
But I just feel that I really do believe this, that sometimes we have to go back to our roots. It's imperative in order to become whole in a way in every aspect of our life. And it happens at different chapters of our life. But to encompass that, you know, where, as I said, where, you know, you have that ancestry from Nigeria. And there's a reason for that, that you were able to play these instruments and so easily. So I think, who knows in life, you know, sometimes an opportunity arises. And I know what you mean about that it's very difficult to see this suffering. But I remember when I was in Central Asia and we were going into the desert because there was a healer there. And the actual healer was healing people with skin conditions. And they were so poor, Phil. It was in the middle of the desert. There was nothing around. And they were lying on these metal beds. And they were so happy because this healer had taken on these people and they were doing drumming as part of a healing session because of they felt that the, you know, we spoke about this a while back when we spoke about the power of sound in healing and the joy that they had from this. They were very ill, but one of the things that he was using amongst many other sort of herbal preparations that society didn't want them. They were nothing in society according, you know, to their people, which of course is not correct, but that is how people view these people. And the joy that we had in spending time with them in being part of these musical drumming sessions, you're on another level of existence, really.
Yeah. I think the vibrations are strongest from going back to the master drummer when he said you must play the drum, you make it sound. You don't hit it, you make it sound. You move the air from the head of the drum through the drum and out into the atmosphere. That's
yeah.
And the vibrations of that are also very healing, very healing. There is drum therapy that people use.
Yes.
Meditation. The shamans have always used drums. Mm-hmm. At that spiritual level, the vibration of any kind of music where the air and the sound waves are disturbed in a certain vibration, it affects people in such wonderful ways.
And you play the drums as well, don't you, Phil?
I do, but not as good as I would like. I'm afraid if I'm recording, I have drum machines that I use. Obviously, I do play percussion live in sessions, but the advancement in digital sequencing, once you've made the program, it's perfect in terms of level. And the idea is to make it sound like a real drummer, not like something that's impossible to play. But I think if you use the instrument properly and use it as an instrument rather as than a shortcut, I think that's fine. And again, you should know about drumming before you use a drum machine.
Yeah. So you've done all of this, and we'll go back a little bit. You worked with major artists, and one of them was Talk Talk for many years, and then with Nina Cherry and all these other people. Mm-hmm. And how long did that part of your life, that chapter, last?
I started to play semi-professionally in Manchester, and we used to work all the working men's clubs around before Mrs. Thatcher had the miners shut. There were clubs everywhere, miners clubs, and these clubs they could hold 800 people seated, and they had very professional stage setups and fullback and monitors. And it was really, if you couldn't play and you didn't play to their standards, you got to know about it and you didn't get rebooked. And at the time, it's quite strange. I'll tell you this little story. I was working as a reprographic technician at the GPO, what was then GPO, now BT. And Monday mornings was terrible because we'd been gigging all weekend. And they eventually said to me that I was 3 minutes late over the month and that I was going to get a warning. And I was on the phone to the sax player and I said to him, I'm getting in trouble. I won't be able to make this rehearsal because I have to work late. And he said, Phil, how much money did you make with the band this weekend? And I said, I think it's probably about 250 quid. Now, this is back in the 70s. And he said, and how much are you making from your day job? And I said, £34.90 a week. And he said, now, who's the fool? The penny dropped, and I left the week after. And so without realising it, I was a professional musician. And then from 1 week to the next, I was definitely a professional musician because I didn't have another job. So after that, it wasn't long before I formed a band that was doing original material and not covering to play for the working men people in the working men's clubs. And that's when we had a band called The Christians in Search of Filth. Now, this band... Well, it was on the era of punk. We're just coming out. And Noel Edmonds had a field day with it on one of his programs. He had a battle of the bands, but it was for the silliest name. And we were third. We were very pleased that we were third. We were behind Stick Soldiers were the winners, and then Bladder Flask were second. And The Christians in Search of Filth for third. But he had a thing about it, and he kept mentioning it. He must have mentioned it three times. So after that, we went to work. We did sessions for John Peel. And at that session, it was the first inkling into professional recording. And the people that were the engineers there were saying, you know, you, sir, meaning me, you should move to London because there's lots of work for somebody like you. And the way you play percussion. So I thought, 8-month-old baby, can I move to London? I wonder. Well, we did. We moved to London. Mm-hmm. Within 21 weeks, I had a gig with Pauline Black. And that was way back when was that started. I think I spent a year with her. And we did a gig at... Victoria Park I think it's in Hackney. Yeah, that's right. And we supported a wonderful band called Joe Boxer, and they had a hit called Just Got Lucky. And I was impressed because their showmanship was amazing. And they were American, and there was a different league. There was a little bit more push with their attitude. And I clocked onto this, and strangely enough, it was the same gig that the road manager from Talk Talk saw me performing. So that was the beginning of the year. And I think when I left Talk Talk, it would be, I think it was 11 years later. Yeah, so it's strange the way things unfold. If I remember correctly, the Christians in Search of Filth had a gig in London, and I remember Mark Hollis coming to watch us, and I was percussion and vocals with that band. I was a lead singer, and we clicked, and we were talking after the gig, and he said he had a terrific stage presence, which was nice of him. But again, there was no hero worship involved. We're just two blokes. And so when the roadie came back and recommended me, he said, oh, well, I know him, get him in. Now, one of the nice things about musical stories is Herbie Hancock, great Herbie keyboard player, used to work with Miles Davis. And I remember a documentary or maybe a book I read, and somebody asked Herbie, how did he know when Miles Davis wanted him in the band? And he said he played a whole set, and Miles said nothing at all to him. And then he went in the next day and played this set again. And as Miles was walking out, he leaned towards him as he was walking past. He didn't break stride, but he just said, "Nice touch, kid." And that was it. He was in. So I'm doing a rehearsal with Talk Talk.
Mm.
And one of the lines in Hate, which is a song that we used to do in the early days, is "Relax Your Stare." And it's the opening line in the song. But what we used to do, and Mark had a particular area of conversing, he'd stop singing halfway through a song. And if you didn't know where you were in it, maybe you're hanging and waiting for his vocal cues, you're in trouble, because obviously you had to know where you were without his vocal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was getting towards the end of the day, and I was thinking, I'm not sure how this is going. And he must have picked the vibe up, because in the middle of the song, where the line wasn't meant to be included, he just looked at me and said, "Relax your stare." Oh, good. So we're in. And in that respect, it was the same as the "nice touch" from Miles Davis. Understatements all the time. No patting each other on the back. It's not one of those situations when you get to that level. Everybody's quite humble in one respect, I would have thought. And again, that's to do with professionalism. But yeah, nice. It was.
Was it something that? I know you were involved in music from a young age, Phil. But is it something that you had always dreamed of doing, and that's why, in a way, it was the promise of your life?
Well, I had a birthday while I was in Nigeria. We left on August 14th. We left Liverpool on a ship called the Oriel, which was a flagship, and we left there. And my sisters sent me out a copy of A Hard Day's Night, the Beatles album. And I couldn't believe it, because we'd been singing the songs of the singles in the playground before I'd left in England. And then the album arrived, and it was warped with the sun. And so I could only play the second half of it, which was quite odd. But yeah. I think from that point, I was desperate to get back, or desperate to have a band like the Beatles, or make music like the Beatles. And it was an anchor, because obviously missing my sisters, I think probably missed my spaniel more, but missing my sisters and my nana and having this album reconnected me with them in a way that was, well, musical. And so, yeah, it was something that was a passion that I wanted to explore. And it, of course, when I found out that my sister was with a musician, he gave me a harmonica before I left. And the way of communicating across the sea then was to do self-tapes on a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And these were just things that we did for fun. And I started to record a very squeaky voice. "This is a Just Blues song." And I played this Suck and Blow blues song and sent it to them and said, "Thank you for my harmonica. This is what I've done on it." And so that's kicking around in the attic somewhere. It makes me laugh. So, yeah, it was very much in my intention to try and be. I always used to get upset because the teachers didn't appreciate me drumming on the wooden desk. And when a wooden school desk is empty, you wouldn't believe what a wonderful resonance it makes if you hit it in the right place. They didn't. "What's that tapping, Reece? Stop that, boy." It was all that business. You know. But I should imagine I was really annoying. I would have thought, yeah, really annoying. Always playing something or whip a pair of sticks out and play on the desk or on a drain pipe if it was.
So it's part of who you are.
I think so.
Yeah. It's part of who you are. I was listening to a composer a couple of weeks ago. He's passed on now, and they were interviewing him. He was an Italian composer, and they said, well, what would you do if you weren't a composer? And he said, well, life wouldn't be worth living, really, because it's actually who I am. It's what is running through me. It's who I am. It's who I stand for. And it's intricately woven into who actually is me. So I totally understand that, don't you? When it's something is so deeply part of your being that without it, you wouldn't really know who you were.
No, so it's difficult, or it has been difficult not being able to perform. But on the other hand, I'm a hoarder of music, and I have one released it's not a single, it's a lament. But obviously, when Mark Hollis died, I had the crazy illusion that one day all the tracks that I've been writing, I'll be able to convince him to come and sing. And of course, he passed away, and I thought, okay, I'll do it myself. But the first thing I did do was to write a lament to him. And strangely enough, when the people from France initially got in touch with me, they were asking me what I'd been doing. And I said, well, I've got a singular song on Bandcamp.com, which is an American site, which is like an online record store, I suppose.
And, Bill, sorry to interrupt you. Just for people listening out there, this French project of yours, so that people know, what is that? So because this is related now, what are you doing at the moment with this French band?
Well, I've just had to sign contracts for exclusive collaborations and the working agreements, according to French law, which basically means I'm a founder member of the band. And from October, we will start recording. I think we're doing 4 tracks this year, and then the next year there's another 6. And the interesting thing about the Spirit of Evolution is it's an international band. There's a French keyboard player, a Spanish keyboard player, an Italian guitarist, and my visit to Africa would probably be, if I do go again, with the Ghanaian musician that's in the band. And the idea of him bringing it internationally together is something that's quite unique. There's only Mel and I that are from England. And so I think they wanted me to be a founder member as percussionist. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they heard Hold On To Bliss, which is the name of the Mark's lament, they then came back and said, okay, we need to get a collaboration contract, because for the next album, we want you to write with us as well, which is marvellous, because little do they know, I've got, I would have thought, 10 years of music on my computers and in various different guises in my studio, ready to go. And that goes back to your initial question of being made up of rhythm and music and melody and charm, which you can put into music, which is quite, what's the correct word? It's quite emotive. It's quite beneficial to the soul, because you can always express yourself with a different instrument. And with the trickery of digital instruments now, when we were recording with Talk, the desk obviously was the control desk. You'd need a really large room. Well, digitally, I have exactly the same desk, but obviously it's on a computer screen. So the same amount of effects and sounds and clarity comes from a mouse rather than a room the size of the Albert Hall, which is another thing that's quite fascinating. And in that respect, I haven't been in any illusion of having my own solo career for a long time in terms of rejection and such. I think EMI said to me, it's very good, but you don't sound black enough. And and Polydor said, you sound like David Sylvian from Japan. And I said, and? And they said, well, and that was that. So I thought, okay, I'll just carry on and do my thing. And lo and behold, when the management from the French band heard it, they basically said, we want you to write songs with us eventually after this album. So again, what goes around comes around, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And everything in the right moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I know that you're a very spiritual person.
I am.
And so it's not sort of, it's not a stranger to your life, this belief system in this way of life of sort of serendipity, that everything happens for a reason and at the right time. And I have to say to the listeners out there that amongst all these wonderful things that Phil does and is involved in and has been involved in, you also, which is something close to my heart, I have to say, you also do reflexology. Is that correct?
It is.
How did you get into that?
Well, strange enough, it goes back to Ballet Rambert again. Dancers' feet, can we say, are hard work and need rest. And what I didn't realise I was doing after sessions was when the dancers came and said, I've got this hurt, my ankle hurts. And I said, okay, let me massage your feet. And I didn't realise at the time it was reflexology, but when they said, you've done wonderful work on my ankle and the bruising's gone, etc., I started to read about reflexology. And then again, years later, I decided to train. And I trained with the London School of Reflexology with Louise Keats, who is the most wonderful practitioner and teacher and my mentor. And from that, I became a member of the Association of Reflexologists. While I was training, I had to have, bearing in mind I was living in London then, away from family and friends, and I had to have something like 60 case notes. And I went to Louise and said, I don't know 60 people in London, I'm afraid. So she said, oh, are you opposed to working at a shelter? A homeless shelter where people drop in the day. And twice a week, there's a treatment room and you can get your cases there. So I did that. And on my first visit, I was given a guy who had a pair of trainers that looked old and a tracksuit. And he was shaking, he was cold. And they said to him, go up and have a shower and go and see him and he'll sort you out. And as I took his shoes off, some of the skin came off with them because he'd had them on for 4 days. And
oh, dear.
He was on serious medication for all sorts of things. And I treated him for 6 sessions. But on the first day, I recommended immediately that he goes to see a doctor. That's one of the things about referrals. You assess somebody. And I said to the caseworker, this lad, I think he was Italian. He got over here on a deal that had gone wrong. And he's only 20, I think he's in his 20s. And he was in the right state. But we reported him and he went to the hospital. They sorted him out. And the next week they came back after 2 sessions. And the caseworker said, I want to see you when you finished with him. And he'd stopped taking his medication after 4 sessions with me. She said, what is it you do? Your reflexology does something that reaches people. And basically, I said, well, I just treated him. But just having somebody there that had an empathy with him, I think, would have been that. He didn't speak any English, which was strange. A lot of the traveling people that were out there wouldn't come in. They explained to me that they didn't mind me treating them because I'd understand. And when I asked them what they meant, they said, well, the man that was here last time was a white man with a white coat, and we didn't like him because he was a doctor. You're a different type of doctor. So I had to stop him and say, well, you know, I'm nowhere near a doctor, please. but the realization that...
Interesting.
The realization that they saw me as being unthreatening in that respect in an authoritarian way was nice, I think. And they responded. And there was a Polish man that used to turn up with his Sainsbury's trolley with all his gear in it. And as soon as he saw me, he'd shout out, ah, doctor, they are my doctor. It was quite embarrassing.
do you know, it's fascinating, Phil. Hold that thought. Because what's coming back to me is when you were 9 years old and you were with this drummer in Lagos. Because to me, he was like the medicine man.
Absolutely. He had,
and somehow he initiated you at that time, at that age, without you even realizing that one day that you would be here and helping these people.
I didn't hesitate, I think. I think that's what it was. It was a natural, these people need help in that respect. Going back to the medicine man, actually, I forgot to mention, he had the most, with his African robes, but he had the most amazing scent. Africa has its own scent anyway, but I'm convinced it was a form of, it wasn't exactly patchouli oil, but it was something that strong.
Yeah.
It was mesmeric. If you'd been with him for half an hour, you started to almost hallucinate with this warm, unbelievable aura, and the nasal passages just seemed to open up, and you could breathe in his essence. It was quite an amazing character.
I sense it, you know, from you when you were talking about him, and I thought about, I wonder, because people like this that have this presence about them, which is somehow otherworldly, isn't it?
Absolutely.
With this fragrance, one of my, oh my goodness, the loves of my life is fragrance and perfume, and people that know me know it, because I'm totally, you know, I have this strong sort of sense for fragrance, because I also do aromatherapy and make perfumes. And I wanted to ask you, is that something that you include in your treatment, the use of essential oils?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. I always make sure that we do a little patch test if I'm using any kind of oil as a massage oil. But if I'm going to burn something, I usually ask who and what they prefer, if they have any preference. And I think, again, that changes the vibrations when you can enhance that's soothing.
Yes, because it takes you, for example, they say that smell is something that is the most evocative of all things that can take you back, you know, in your life as a memory. You have to do is smell, and that's it. You're back to where you were in that moment.
That's right. In an instant. That's exactly right.
That's the magic of it, I think. And that's how I imagine your Lagos master and initiating you at a young age and you not even knowing, and all these smells and all, you know, I think it's fascinating. And I wonder, is that something that, do you think you're going to use that with your music and your musical skills, this healing methods?
Before I play a percussion, I always oil my hands, and therefore my drum heads have got I used to use coconut butter years ago. And I think my drum heads are infused with that now, because obviously I've never changed my drums. With if I buy when I bought them or when they were bought for me, they stay with me. I don't swap and change instruments, so that most of them I've had most of my life. And again, yeah, they have an essence. The leather straps on my bass guitars have got my scent on them somehow. And yes, it is. It's a very sensual part of music. The whole aura around the feeling and the vibrations that you get from sound, and again from essence, from smell.
I'm smiling because I'm thinking to myself of, you know, you involved in a sort of a seminar, a type of healing workshop where there is burning incense, and it really does work, I have to say to the people out there. I've been involved in things like that. I still am, where you have the drumming or the percussion, you have the music and you have the smell, and you have this, you know, healing of the music. Is that something you've ever combined?
I think it is, maybe unintentionally. Some of the music that I've recorded, I'll play back and meditate with.
For people who want to hear more of your music, where can they hear it?
Well, the track that I've written as a lament for Mark is on bandcamp.com. And you look for my name as the artist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Hold On To Bliss, which is an anagram of Hollis.
And okay.
In deference to him, the lyric is a piece of haiku or a three-liner. Bandcamp.
And it's Bandcamp, is it?
Bandcamp, yeah. Bandcamp, bandcamp.com.
And here they can hear that particular piece. And what about other music of yours? Where can they get hold of that?
Really possibly can't, because there's not much that I've released other than with various different artists.
But, so, for example, what? Talk Talk?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot that I won't admit to.
Is it a bit like what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas type of thing? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot more. Dear.
But we were talking about this earlier, which I'm going to have a look at later, is Talk Talk at Hammersmith in 1986, was it? Is where one of your...
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That was a major thing that you played in as well.
That was a wonderful gig, yeah.
So
it was nice. There's lots of stuff on YouTube, but I think that as that's a complete gig and a piece. And it is also out on DVD as well, that one. But we have... There's more in the waiting list that'll be released at whatever dates. And that, again, that's something that I'm really quite... excited about, because obviously with the distribution of the new band, the new French band, there'll be opportunities for me to actually put out solo music with them. Because years ago, the French wanted me to sign a solo album while I was with Talk Talk. And this is one of the reasons why I think they wanted me to join the Spirits Evolution. They have a liking for Talk Talk, and it's still played quite a lot on their radios and various different shows. The status of that, I think we went gold first in France, and they were really kind to me. And it, obviously, it's come back to be kind even more today, which is
Now, Talk Talk, they existed for how long?
Well, with that, the Hammersmith gig was the last one, and then Mark went solo. He went on his own after that. So that should be around 10 years. Yeah. So, well, in fact, it was longer because Mark carried on into the 90s with Laughingstock and Mark Hollis' self-titled album. Yeah.
And how did you feel, you know, when you were in this famous band and working with all these well-known people, and that you were part of that success? How does it feel? Do you still to this day say, oh my goodness, you know, there I was and here I am, and how wonderful it is that I'm a musician and this has been my life? Do you sometimes have to pinch yourself?
I know, I hope it doesn't sound too arrogant, but not really. There is a point where you have to still pay the milkman and get up in the morning. I understand that if I was to broadcast people that I know and what I've done and waft my CV about, it'll be like fantasy to most people. I appreciate that.
What I'm saying to you. People can only dream of working, you know, with the people you've worked with, being the musician that you are. It's things that dreams are made of for many people that won't achieve it as musicians, but you have.
Yes.
So there has to be that element of grace, I think, that you were blessed to do something and are still doing what you love. It's a remarkable achievement in life.
It is, and I do appreciate it. It comes close. There are people that still say it's not a real job, obviously.
Well,
and that, maybe that comes with a bit of jealousy, I suppose.
But they're not artists, then.
No, that's the sad point. They cut themselves off the more artistic side of life isn't anything that they're interested in, which I find quite alien. And it's quite a secluded thought that people can't imagine anything other than what they do.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it's part of frustration when you get to believe that all your friends and people that you can confide in do the same thing, but they're all over the world in different places. Mm-hmm. And if you mention it to people that don't know you very well, they sometimes take it as a snub or what a terrible bore, what a bully, a show-off, perhaps. And so that in that respect, we being the fraternity of professionals, isolated, I think, in a lot of our thoughts. I think this is the reason why I've never stopped recording, because
it's true, actually. You are isolated in some ways. It's sort of a seclusion of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
From everybody, because when you tell people things that, you know, they could only dream about, or you've worked with people that, you know, most people would admire.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's a different world. People don't understand it unless they're part of the either the entertainments or the music industry or the filming or whatever it is, whatever art it is. There is a certain essence that flows through artists that's very sort of crazy, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, I must tell you, after going back to university as a mature student, my first audition after doing my drama and music degree, I got a gig with the American Drama Company. I've not told you this, Mimi. We were doing, as I found out, Animal Farm, a version of Animal Farm, and five actors. And it was a musical, rather than musical theatre, it was a musical abstraction of Animal Farm. And I played percussion and sang, and the whole ensemble sang.
and I played harmonica. And we did a seven-month world tour with 136 performances in 112 theatres, 14 countries, and 10 days off between Singapore and China, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was quite odd, because being on stage as an actor, you can affect people by three rows back. If you throw a punch, they actually flinch, and that used to used to give me such a thrill to do this. And then obviously I was playing as well, so that was quite a ride. Yeah, that was a journey. It took
how long ago did you do that?
That was 1995. Yeah,
95. And how long did you do that for?
7 months.
Seven months, right.
Started off, rehearsed in Munich in January the 3rd, and it was it was 12 below in Munich. And then the first shows were in Oulu in Finland, which is right at the top of Finland, and it was 35 degrees below freezing in the wind chill. And we ended up in the July in Singapore, and it was 35 above. So we did the whole temperature thing as well as... I've actually got a warning.
The different extremes.
Yeah. Got a warning here for people. Look before you leap. I was in a sauna in Finland, and there was a wonderful cabin and a field with a round hole with one of those ladders like you get in a swimming pool. Mm-hmm. And this was the cold plunge. And me being gung-ho at that time, came running out of the sauna and dived, feet first, into the hole, only to come up and bump my head on the ice above. It wasn't a plunge pool. It was a lake.
Oh, my goodness.
I panicked almost for a minute. The sharp intake of breath didn't happen, luckily. And as the bubbles subsided, I turned around to see a shaft of light where the hole let the light in, and I managed to swim back and crawl up the ladder. Look before you leap, dear listeners. So, it's not recommended. And I didn't realise that the whole of that field was a lake, but it had snow over it and 4 foot of ice. So...
Oh, God, that sounds like a nightmare.
Well, it gets better, because we were in the Hong Kong in the South China Sea, and where the dragon boat races are, they have nets that partition, for want of a better word, the swimming area from the dragon boat area. And there was a report that a shark had been in the area and it bitten somebody's toes off or something terrible. And I went out swimming, and the South China Sea is full of algae, or green soup. And if you put your hand under the water, you can't see it. And at the end of your wrist, it's gone. It's just green. And I was swimming out and realized that the tide was so strong, I pulled myself back on this dragon boat net, and I was dragging myself up. And as the waves ebbed, there was a really large, like a billboard on these nets. And when the nets are tight, this billboard would have hung down and it had a sign on it. But when the waves ebbed, it's lifted up so it was flat on top of the water. And then it was taut and it went back down and it went horizontal again. And then it went vertical. And I was pulling myself up thinking this is better than swimming, because as I was swimming, I was doing two strokes forward and going two strokes back. I thought, right, okay, this is far too strong. I'll pull myself along. And when I got to the board, it said, caution, shark net.
Oh, my God.
At that point, I panicked, and my foot slipped through the mesh. And I thought, don't panic. But I'd already panicked. And I pulled myself back to the shore where my friend was waving at me, and he was 3 inches tall. on the beach when I had to pull myself all the way back. That was a nightmare, Mimi.
Oh gosh. Have you thought of writing a book about all these adventures?
Do you know, I'm looking for a publisher at the moment. I have got reams and reams of manuscripts that I'm
right. Me and you are going to have a chat.
Okay.
We shall save that for our little chats. Okay. We shall have a chat about that because I have a little idea there. But yeah, because this would be fantastic to read about all these adventures. My goodness.
Yeah, well, yeah.
More about that later. Now. Okay. Oh, gosh, it's fantastic, really, to talk to you and to listen to these stories. There's so many of them.
There's far more.
You could never get bored listening to you.
Well, let's hope not.
For sure. Do you know what? I see you, even though I know what you do and everything, but I still see you as a medicine man that is like a famous songwriter, but you're still a medicine man. And this calmness and this serenity that you have around you is something really quite special, because it's rare these days that someone has that calmness about them and this sort of self-assuredness.
Well, a friend of mine gave me a belt buckle, which is one of my prized possessions, and it's of an American, North American Indian Brujo, who's a medicine man.
And no, really?
My grandfather on my mother's side was an American Indian. He was a traveller that came to Stockport. My mother was born in 1919, God rest her soul.
God bless her.
He was a thespian who came and obviously fell in love with my nana.
Mm-hmm.
My mum was born, but people used to think that my mum resembled a squaw. She was quite slight, and so I do have the other side of me, on my mum's side, on my grandparents' side, I do have North American Indian. And I always thought that was marvellous because it's people used to say I look like Jimi Hendrix, which I obviously don't, but that, I took that straight away as a kid. They're all the 15-year-old Jimi Hendrix. Yeah.
Oh, you see?
Mm-hmm. See? When he gave me this belt buckle, and when I send you the MP3, I'll send you a picture of it.
Okay.
And it's wonderful. I've been offered a lot of money for it. Well, No.
You can't get rid of that. Definitely not.
Went to buy a watch in Switzerland, and I had this belt buckle on, and there were pocket watches that had the same enameled, painted surfaces. And when the jeweler saw it, he looked at it and he said, "This is the most impressive piece. Would you like to swap it?" And he offered me a Rolex. And I said, "No, thank you."
No, not at all.
No.
Good for you.
Nope. So I shall send you a picture of that, Mimi.
Yes, please do. I should be very interested in that. Ah, you see.
In fact, I'm wearing it now. It's my protector. So I shall
send it's like your amulet.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I gathered that. Mm-hmm. That's what's so wonderful. I think incredible. And we have to get you doing a retreat.
That would be wonderful. I'd love that.
That's what we're going to do. Oh, and for the listeners out there, Phil and I are going to collaborate and do a retreat with all these wonderful things, because I do sense this sort of wise healer there that it's time now for you to sort of, you know, become a little bit more well-known in that field instead of hiding yourself like a secret squirrel there. Yeah. But it's been wonderful, really. And come again and just play your music even. And I should be very happy. And I'm sure people out there will be very happy to hear that. But thank you so much for coming on, Phil.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, really.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Me too. And as I said, come back again.
I'd love to.
Anytime. All right, then. Well, take care of yourself.
I will. And you too, Mimi.
Thank you so much. Until next time, look after yourself.
And you.
All right, then. Take care, Phil. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Phil Rees. How wonderful, really. And I'm so delighted always to have these wonderful, wonderful guests that make my life really brighter to hear their stories. Now, until next time, look after yourselves. Lots of love, wishing you beautiful moments. And coming up now is a little bit of music from Phil Rees. Enjoy.
Thank you for listening to Secrets for an Inspirational Life, brought to you by your host, Mimi Novick. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast and see you in the next episode. For more information about Mimi Novick, and her books, music, and inspirational work, take a look at her website, www.miminovic.co.uk.